Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Tom Horton. He covered environmental issues for the Baltimore Sun from 1974 till 2006. He's author of several books about Chesapeake Bay. He's written for magazines including National Geographic, Rolling Stone, the New York Times, and the Boston Globe. He teaches writing and environmental studies at Salisbury University and contributes regularly to Chesapeake Bay Magazine and the Bay Journal News Service. Horton worked for 5 years as an educator at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, where he authored Turning the Tide, a book on solutions to the Chesapeake's water quality problems. So I would like to thank you first for your work, and I would also like to thank you for being on the program.
Well, good to be here, Derek.
Oh, thanks. So can you give people an introduction to Chesapeake Bay and its history, and its ecological history, and then its current state?
Sure. The Chesapeake is one of the world's largest and most productive coastal water bodies. It's technically an estuary, which is where the ocean comes into the coastline and fresh water from several rivers comes down and mixes with it. So you have this range of water over a couple hundred miles from around Norfolk, Virginia, where it's almost oceanic in salt, to above Baltimore, Maryland, where it's pretty much fresh water, and everything in between. And it basically creates some of the world's most productive areas with its wetlands and its seagrass meadows and its oyster beds. It's a world-class, or is or was a world-class producer of crabs and oysters and several kinds of fin fish like the striped bass, which is almost an iconic East Coast sport and commercial fish. So just a good place for life. And it's also very attractive to humans. In my lifetime, which is almost 70 years, the number of humans living in the drainage basin or watershed of the Chesapeake have gone from about 7 million to about 17.5. We include Washington, Baltimore, Richmond, and the watershed is just gigantic. It covers a sixth of the East Coast. It goes up north as far as Cooperstown, New York, a lot of the land between Vermont and North Carolina, basically, and out into West Virginia drains into the Chesapeake. And what that means ecologically and for purposes of cleaning up the Chesapeake is you got to pay a lot of attention to what you do on the landscape, good and bad, because there's a whole lot of land, 64,000 square miles, all draining down into a fairly shallow bay, and that's Chesapeake Bay in a nutshell. It's a extremely productive body of water that drains a huge amount of the East Coast landscape.
When I read accounts of, I live up in salmon country in the Pacific Northwest, and
yeah.
When I read accounts of the what the rivers were like prior to conquest, there are accounts of entire rivers where you cannot see the bottom of the river because there are so many fish. And when I read about what the oceans were like off of Cape Cod, it looked like there was always mist in the air because there were so many whales, and whales were a hazard to shipping. And it's just, we hear about passenger pigeons with 6 billion, and sometimes there would be so many they would cover the sky for days at a time. And so I'm presuming that with it being that, as you said, productive, can you give some accounts that you may know or you may have heard of various, just how, I'm presuming, how ridiculously fecund it was prior to contact, like horseshoe crabs or I don't know how to pronounce it, Menhaden?
Yeah, Menhaden. They're sort of the base of the food chain for so many species. They're a little oily fish, which are basically packets of fat, packets of energy, and everything from migrating loons to all of the top of the food line fish feed on those menhaden, and they're a very critical part of the food web. And yeah, the old accounts, there's two ways to look at these old accounts of fecundity. One is absolutely, I mean, the rivers in the spring all over the Chesapeake and the East Coast ran thick with migrating spawning fish. We aren't so lucky as to have your Pacific salmon, but we had shad and we had herring and we had white perch and striped bass and yellow perch, many other species. There are many accounts of people being able to go out as recently as the turn of the 20th century, the early 1900s, and catch in an hour more crabs, blue crabs or our crabs, more than you could catch in a week now. So these accounts are true. Now, the other thing you have to watch, though, is we often go by harvest figures. You will hear the Chesapeake once produced 15 million bushels of oysters a year. Something like two out of every five people fishing for a living in the U.S. were catching oysters on the Chesapeake. That, on the one hand, gives you an idea of how many oysters there were here. On the other hand, that kind of harvest was strip mining. That was not a sustainable harvest. So you have to be a little careful of the old numbers. Not that they aren't true. If anything, they're probably an underestimate, but they also were not sustainable. And we were, there are accounts of taking, I don't know, 7 or 8 rail car loads a night of shad, which is a beautiful sport and commercial fish, out of ports like Chrisfield on the Chesapeake, Chrisfield, Maryland. And again, that shows you there were train car loads of shad coming up the bay, but it also was probably not a sustainable fishing. As you can see now, we have a closed season on shad since 1978 in Maryland. I should mention too, Derek, when we talk about the Chesapeake, there are 6 states in the watershed going up to New York, out to West Virginia, but basically Maryland and Virginia share the Chesapeake. They surround it, Maryland on its northern end, Virginia on its southern end. So they would be the principal bay states as far as harvesting the bay and having cultural and historic attachments to the Chesapeake. Probably the river most of your listeners would know best is not the biggest river in the bay, but it's a pretty fine river, the Potomac, which flows down through Washington, D.C. and into the Chesapeake.
So I'm glad you said the thing about the non-sustainable removal of fish or whomever. And I think that's a wonderful point, and I completely agree. And the same is true for salmon harvesting out here. Even if you take out the dams, just the salmon harvesting itself by the dominant culture has not been sustainable. And but the thing I'm always most interested in are the actual accounts of somebody looking at a river and seeing, like, it's for the Pacific Northwest, there were places up in BC where one of the things the Indians would do that I just found extraordinary is they would throw a pebble, just for fun, they would throw a pebble into a creek, and then they would count how long it would take for the pebble to reach the bottom of the creek because it would land on the backs of salmon and not find a way to fall down. And,
wow.
You know, these days, it's almost, there's actually, we're having a huge storm as we speak, and so there will probably be some salmon running up pretty quick because they love it when it storms. And these days, we're really lucky when we see, I've been on salmon spawning tours, and we're lucky when we see a dozen fish. And anyway, back to the point, I've mentioned them a couple of times. You didn't mention them here, but I know maybe I'm just mentioning them, not because maybe they're not so important to Chesapeake Bay, I don't know, but because I've heard about them so much. Didn't there used to be just tons of horseshoe crabs too?
Well, the bay has a healthy population of horseshoe crabs. Actually, the epicenter of the horseshoe crab universe is one bay over in Delaware Bay. It's just across the peninsula where I live, the eastern shore of Maryland, which is hangs down between Chesapeake and Delaware Bays. Delaware Bay always had a lot more horseshoe crabs. I mean, maybe 10 times what the Chesapeake had. I mean, both of them, you can find reports of beaches usually in May or June covered with horseshoe crabs crawling out. But I think that was a bigger deal and still is a bigger deal on Delaware Bay. I mean, they're an important part of the system here on the Chesapeake, but our most abundant crab really is the blue crab, which is a whole different species. Horseshoe crabs are not a true crab. They're closer to spiders, really, than to the crabs, but we had quite an abundance of them, but nothing like Delaware Bay.
So let's go back to you mentioned oysters earlier, and
yeah,
I was just reading something the other day that at one time, okay, and readers may not know about, and I don't really know how it works, but I know that oysters are supposed to, one of the things that they do is filter water. And I was just reading the other day that at one point there were so many oysters that basically all the water could be filtered by them in the bay in 3 days. And I believe it takes 300 and some days now.
You get variations of that. But, yeah, essentially the filtering capacity of the original oyster population in the bay was, volumes of water equivalent to all the water in the bay. Every few to several days, and now it would take the remaining oysters estimated at maybe less than 1% of original populations. It would take them the better part of the year. But I guess we should back up and say, why does that matter? And it matters because one of the principal declines we've experienced in Chesapeake Bay is related to the fact that the bay has gone in the last century or so from very clear water to cloudy water. Why? Because it's now full of algae, which is a product of too much fertilizer, nitrogen and phosphorus washing in from just about everything humans do, from sewage, from dirty air, from farm fertilizers, from animal manures, from deforestation. So the oysters, if you take a gallon jug of water out of the bay and put a bunch of oysters in it and mix it all up, it's pretty opaque. And within a couple hours, it's pretty clear because of the oysters filtering.
And what do they do? Do they suck the water in and spit it out or something?
They take the water in and they feed on algae in it. And they incorporate the undigested algae and the sediment into what is called pseudo-feces. It's like oyster poop, and they poop it out, and it goes to the bottom. But it goes to the bottom in a form that doesn't cloud up the water or cause pollution. So they're basically, it's kind of like the filter in your fish aquarium at home. You know, think about it. What if you took 99.7% of the filter in your aquarium out? Aquarium and the fish would not be doing so good. And of course, oysters alone didn't keep the bay clean. We were putting a lot less pollution into the bay back then. We had a lot more forests on the watershed, which let a lot less, the runoff from the land was much clearer and cleaner because it came through forests rather than off pavements and golf courses and lawns and farms. So it's the challenge really of restoring the Chesapeake, which became a prime focus of the states in the watershed and the federal government back in 1983. The focus really is to change the way humans are doing business in every way, from air pollution to water pollution to land use, in addition to limiting our harvests. So it's kind of an interesting restoration because there's no single source of it. It's almost everything we humans do, and we're having to address almost everything we humans do to have any hope of bringing the bay back to a clearer, cleaner body of water. And so far, that's been difficult. We got a lot of battles won, but don't ask how the war is going. Not as well as we hoped.
So a couple things. One of them is that so far as the clearness of the water, one of the things I read when I was preparing for the interview is that at one point it would be that you could see several meters into the water. And at this point, a lot of times when people go wading, by the time you're up to your knees, you can't see your feet. Is that true?
That's very true. And I should point out, the Chesapeake, typical of coastal water bodies, was never in the temperate zone here, was never clear like Caribbean clear, not like Great Barrier Reef clear. It's a very different ecosystem, always more nutrient rich, more algae rich, more sediment rich than some of these extremely clear waters that exist or used to exist on Earth where you have coral reefs. So we aren't talking clear like you could see 90 or 100 feet down. I've been in waters like that when I lived on the Red Sea back in the 60s, but not like that. But yes, we have accounts from the 1950s of people coming out of creek and looking 10 or 15 feet down and seeing diamondback terrapins, that's our state reptile in Maryland, crawling on the bottom. And now if you went out those creeks, you'd be lucky to see a couple feet down. And that's sediment and algae and over-fertilization. And
So let's be really, go ahead. So let's be really, really basic. And why is that bad for a river? Why is that bad for the bay to, why is that turbidity or whatever we want to call it? Why is that bad for the bay? And why is that
Well,
bad for those who live in the bay?
I guess the big picture is to over-fertilization with nutrients and sediment. It's like food. Some of it is not only good, it's necessary for survival, but too much of it, you get fat, and way too much of it, you get morbidly obese, and you get diabetes, and you die, and all that stuff. So it's too much of a good thing. One of the biggest consequences, and it really was one of the things that triggered the decision to try and restore the bay, was a widespread disappearance in the 70s, 1970s, of the bay's seagrass meadows. And these are underwater grasses that grew over hundreds of thousands of acres around the bay. They're incredibly productive habitat for everything from shrimp and little crabs to juvenile fish. They're probably, along with mangroves, corals, wetlands, seagrass meadows are one of the four or five most productive habitats on the planet. They don't get the press of coral reefs, but they're equally important and they're equally in trouble, maybe more so. So the Chesapeake was, this was iconic. I mean, the Chesapeake shallows were carpeted by these grasses, some 14 varieties, but we call them submerged aquatic vegetation for short. And they just declined dramatically. And it turned out, after a good bit of scientific research during the 70s, that they just weren't getting enough light because the water had gotten too cloudy. And it got too cloudy from too much algae growing, from too much fertilizer being pumped into the water, and from sediment. So that's the biggest reason why cloudy is a problem. It's killed off one of our major habitats.
And how is the seagrass doing now?
We have It's overall not so well. We are still far, far below the recovery goals set by the Environmental Protection Agency, and even farther below what the original habitats were. We're not even close to recovery to our restoration goals. Now, within that picture, remember, we're talking about a bay that stretches a couple hundred miles in length and up to 25 or 30 miles. So it's a big area. And within that area, there are some substantial areas where we've had some very good comebacks of these grasses in the upper bay, as good as anything I've seen in my lifetime. But overall, particularly in the middle and southern parts of the bay, things are just not responding to pollution controls to date. And one of the things that's pretty interesting and a little scary is that some of that lack of comeback may be related to climate change. The water in the Chesapeake has gotten, it's well documented, it's gotten a couple, 3 degrees warmer over the last several decades. And one of the primary grasses, eelgrass, is already on the southern limits of its range, and that warmer water is making it very difficult for eelgrass to come back, combined with the cloudier water. And that's a problem because, you know, EPA can pass regulations to clear up the water, but they can't really pass a regulation to cool it off, not in the meaningful term. You know, we can crank down on CO2 and eventually see a change, but it's a long response time.
Well, speaking of CO2, one of the things I've heard, I don't know much about seagrass, but I have read a couple articles within the past couple months about how it's supposed to be one of the best biomes for carbon sequestration.
Yeah, it does that. It also oxygenates the water. It also settles out sediment very well. It's remarkable what a difference it can make. I was kayaking one night on the bay and thought I was going to turn over. I was maybe a mile from my destination, and it's dark, and all of a sudden I'm still out there a mile in open water, and all of a sudden it just gets calm. The wind is whistling. And I got to shore the next morning. I got up and I could see why. There was a big seagrass bed out there, and it even in pretty choppy water and 20-knot winds, it just settled the water down. And it does the same thing with sediment. It just clarifies the water. So again, just as we had these vast quantities of oysters filtering the water, we had these vast meadows of seagrasses in a different way, kind of doing the same thing. And you start to put those together and then put that together with a more forested watershed, and you begin to see very easily how this bay was a much clearer and healthier body of water before we destroyed a large part of those systems.
So I've never seen, I mean, to my knowledge, I've never seen seagrass. When you talk about that, what does it, can you give people just once again, just real basics, like is seagrass 4 inches long? Is it like 3 feet long? Does it go up above the top of the water? Or is it, how deep is the seagrass bed usually? Is it 50 feet down? Is it 5 feet down? 1 foot down?
The first distinction I'd make, especially for you West Coast people, it's not like kelp, which can grow very, very deep, like you'd see out in Monterey Bay if you're kayaking out there or on a boat. That's a different system altogether. Seagrasses normally grow in water up to about 3, 4, maybe 5 meters deep. At low tide, yes, they can literally lie on the surface. And they typically grow along inside, not on the ocean side. They can't root in that energetic water. They're generally in protected embayments, and they can cover, they covered hundreds of thousands of acres in the Chesapeake. Now they cover more like tens of thousands of acres. We're way down on that, and they are in decline for much the same reasons: too much fertilizer, growing too much algae, making the water too cloudy. All over. They have the same problems in Asia, the same problems in Australia, the same problems in the Baltic Sea. Seagrasses, they like I say, if you Google coral reefs and then Google seagrasses, you get way, way fewer citations on seagrasses, yet they are equally important. They just don't get the ink, the press, not as spectacular, but they're very important habitats, and they're in decline most places.
So two things, and you can take either one of these or both or neither, whatever you want. One of them is that it's one of the things, and I've written about this in many, many books. It stuns me again and again how we see these same patterns over and over, and we all, you know, so often we like to consider ourselves the smartest species on the planet, which I think is nonsense, but because I think non-humans are just as sentient as we are. But the point here is that there's these patterns. You said it's happening all over the globe, and yet we seem to persist in doing the same things over and over. And
well, you know, one way to look at this is in terms of coastal edges. You know, our coastal fringes, where the sea and the continents overlap, which are where our Chesapeake Bays, our Baltic Seas, our San Francisco Bays, Hong Kong harbors, whatever are. That's where a lot of the aquatic productivity of the planet is. It's where a lot of the planet's nature, from seabirds to wading birds to marsh birds to juvenile fishes and crabs, and it's where it makes its living along those edges. It's where the humans are too. You know, about half of the people on Earth live on about 5 or 6% of the planet. And where is that 5 or 6%? Hey, it's waterfront, baby. Everybody for a long time has wanted to put their big cities, whether it be London or Chicago on the Great Lakes or LA, you know, on the edge. It's where the ships could get, it's where you can discharge your waste. So, you know, what you got is so much of the nature on the planet trying to make its living along these very productive edges of land and water. And it's also where humans, who are part of nature, a rather special part, but part of nature. So, you know, if I had to sum up my 40 years of writing about the Chesapeake, which if you unwind all of its shoreline has about 11,000 miles of edges, land, water edges. That's what I've been writing about, this tension. Can humans and the rest of nature find some peaceful coexistence around the edges where they all seem to want to make their living? And so far, we haven't figured out really how to do that.
Yeah.
And I think part of the answer is going to be stepping back. We may have to, with sea level rise around the Chesapeake. I more and more think part of the answer is we can't have a world of 12, 13 billion people, you know, and protect the rest of nature very well. We kind of operate on that assumption, but I don't think it's a good assumption.
Yeah, overshoot is definitely real.
Sure.
I completely agree with you. So the other direction I was going to go with that is that I remember also, as I was preparing for the interview, that I read that in the 1970s, Chesapeake Bay was discovered to have one of the planet's first marine dead zones. And so, A, can you talk about dead zones, which seems to be sort of the direction a lot of this, you know, these algae blooms and all that go. And then can you talk about how Chesapeake Bay is for the hypoxic zones today?
Yeah, the dead zones are basically, the scientists would say they're zones of hypoxic, meaning low oxygen water, or anoxic water, which is no oxygen at all. They're places where you don't find much life, and they tend to form In the deeper waters along the channels, usually in hot summers. And it's the same problem that's killing the seagrasses. It's too much fertilizer, nitrogen, phosphorus feeding, too much algae, which dies, and when it decomposes, it sucks up oxygen. And yeah, that was the other thing that got our attention between the 50s and the 70s, the dead zone. And a little bit of a dead zone is perhaps a permanent condition of a lot of estuaries. I'm not sure there was ever a time when there was never anoxic water ever in the Chesapeake, but it's far larger now. And like the seagrasses, we have kept it from getting worse, but it's not gotten a lot better. And the last paper I read said there were about 450 some documented dead zones around the world, and you name the continent, they've got them. And generally, the causes are the same: too much fertilizers from human activities, agriculture and industry, fueling too much algae. You know, there was one case, and I think it is the only case where a dead zone was reversed, and it was over on the Black Sea, and the problem is that what reversed it was a decline in fertilizers, nutrients, due to the collapse of the Soviet Empire. So, you know, collapse of empire is perhaps not the way we choose to solve our dead zone problems, but it did cut pollution by about what scientists think we need to cut it on the Chesapeake. The question is how to do that and not collapse the economy.
Actually, for what it's worth, my perspective is that, the real world is actually more important than the economy. So,
we could get into a whole nother show, but the way we run our economy now, it's, I think, probably inherently degrading of nature. We like to think we can run it this way and just tweak it greener, and that'll be enough. I suspect the answer to that is no. You can do it on a piece of paper, but you can't really do it. That's not to say we can't and haven't greened some parts of the current economic system, but I'm not sure you can have an economy that is dedicated to constant, never-ending growth and make it so green. You know, if you could go to a carbonless economy, perhaps, but
it would still be extractive. And I completely agree with you. And at the same time, I also agree. You know, I've written about this in any number of books too, that I don't believe in the reform versus revolution dichotomy, because if we all wait for the great glorious revolution, there's nothing left. I mean, I'm a complete pragmatist. You know, whatever helps the prairie dogs, I'm for it. Whatever helps the bay, whether it's, you know, whether it's regulation or whether it's collapse of empire, it's like let's talk about the bay.
Well, you know, I walk that tension, as do a lot of other profs here at where I teach at Salisbury University in Maryland. I teach a Chesapeake Bay course, and I sort of tell the students, we're going to talk about two or three levels here. Here's all the things that you can do now: join the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, join the Sierra Club, Chesapeake chapters, and you can do now that are good for the Bay. Here's all the big picture things, like reforming the economy, stabilizing population, that if you don't do someday, all of the here and now efforts aren't going to amount to a hill of beans. But don't stop, you know, recycling and buying a Prius instead of an SUV. Do all those things, but keep in mind they are not going to win the war. So I agree. You can't just wait for the revolution or the workers' paradise or whatever you're waiting for. You've got to work through existing channels as best you can now. But you've also got to keep fully in mind that this is probably not the way home.
Yeah. That's great. You put that really well. So we have about 10, 12 minutes left, and there's a question I would like to ask before we start winding down, which is, so can you, like, choose four or five of the indicators of the bay or the species that are especially important to you or the biomes that are especially important to you, like the seagrass or whomever, whatever. And could you then talk about when the trends for each of those, like an example would be bison really hit the bottom of their situation in North America in the early 20th century, or pronghorn antelope, it was the same thing. Pronghorn antelope, I think there were about 16 million. They got down to about 20,000. Now they're slowly going back up, and they're maybe 100 and some thousand. So they were actually worse in the 20s than now. So can you choose, I don't know what you want, blue crabs, oysters, seagrass, I don't care what. Choose four or five, and then just tell me, like, when they hit bottom, if they did, or if they're still going down, and how quickly they're coming back. Does the question make sense?
Sure. Well, let me start with a classic success, and it was a real big deal. Striped bass, due to pollution and overfishing, by the early 1980s, they were threatened with commercial extinction. I mean, we were heartbeats away from having to just stop catching them. And in fact, Maryland, followed by other states, finally put a virtual moratorium on their harvest for 5 years. And boy, that was a big deal. It would be like if they said no catching salmon for the next 5 years anywhere on the West Coast. Imagine the political angst over that. Well, that's what we did here. And it was big because these striped bass mostly spawn in the Chesapeake, and yet they migrate from New England to North Carolina and spend their lives mostly offshore in those states and then come into the Chesapeake to spawn. So it was a fish of coastwide importance. And striped bass, they're good to eat. You may argue salmon are better, but striped bass are mighty good eating, and they can get to 60 or 70 pounds. They're a ton of fun to catch. But we put a moratorium on, and they have come back and are probably as abundant now as they were at any time in my life, and maybe as abundant as they ever were. There are some, and I'll tell you why I like that success, because let me tell you the ingredients. We did the science that gave the backbone to the politicians to take what was an extremely controversial step. We had good federal oversight, which you have to have when a fish swims through multiple states. We had real enforcement. We had deadlines. We had penalties. We had regulation. None of those will get you elected to office around here these days, saying I'm for rules and penalties and deadlines and strict enforcement. But by gosh, it works. And I'm for funding the science. I'll tell you, where we've done that, we've won. And where we haven't, we've lost. And it really comes down to that. And the striped bass is a good example. The oyster is an example where we haven't, until very recently, the last few years, done nearly enough of that. And we've lost big time. Blue crabs, another place where the Chesapeake outproduced most of the world, and they're very good eating too. Their Latin and Greek combination name, Callinictes sapidus, means most savory, beautiful swimmer, and they are a beautiful animal and darn good eating. We have they have hit historic lows in recent years, but I think we have finally started to manage them with good enough science that we know how to set sustainable levels of harvest. And I think that's going to win the day for the blue crab. So I wouldn't have told you this 5 years ago, and maybe not even 3 years ago, but now, even though I think they bottomed out, and we can bring them on back. One hooker in all this, as you probably know, is what's climate change going to do? It makes everything more of a moving target. But those are two examples. One example where we have had real success, and this was kind of a simple one. We started removing dams, not giant dams, but lots of small dams. And we have around the Chesapeake system reopened, I think a few thousand miles or more of spawning habitat around Chesapeake rivers now. And that's been a significant achievement, and there's more work to be done. But I suppose you could say we had bottomed out as far as damming a lot of our rivers and creeks, and we've reversed that. The biggest challenge we've got left, by far agriculture, growing our food, is the biggest source of pollution in the Chesapeake. It was sort of left out of the 1972 Clean Water Act reforms, and we're still paying for that. We don't have the EPA, and the states don't have the legal authority over farms to the extent they do over smokestacks and tailpipes and industrial and sewage outfalls. And again, it shows. So we really have to figure out somehow in this world how to feed 7 or 8 billion without fouling the water. And I don't really know of any country that's figured that one out. We can surely do a better job, and farmers are making some progress. They're doing a lot, but there's a lot more to be done. Just the sheer scale of row cropping, growing corn and soybeans to feed to cattle and dairy cows and chickens. That's a pretty luxurious way to get your calories, and it's pretty hard on the earth. And when you do it around places like the Chesapeake, it shows up in cloudy water and dead zones.
What you say makes a lot of sense. And I want to go back to what you said about the dam removal. And that actually brings me to, I don't have very much optimism for the future, but one of the things that does give me some optimism, and this is the same for what you said about the dead zone in the Black Sea, that one of the things that does give me some optimism is how quickly fish, when you take out a dam, how quickly fish come home. It's stunning to me that I mean, they think, oh, it might take them years to come back, and sometimes within 2 weeks, the fish are swimming back home.
Well, we have a big dam on the head of the Chesapeake, Conowingo, across our biggest river, the Susquehanna. And it's been there since 1920. It's been there almost a century. And every year, those shad and herring come back from the oceans, and they bump right up against that big 110-foot high slab of concrete. And in my dreams, I think, that seems like a very unequal match, these soft-fleshed fish bumping against 110 feet of concrete. But they keep coming. And we are trying some things like lifting them across that dam. And they do some spawning below the dam, but there's 450 miles of former habitat, plus all the creeks. I mean, thousands of miles of spawning blocked off there. But I like to think those fish are going to win out. I'm not sure, and certainly not in my watch, but the resilience of nature, I don't want to make too much of it, because there are growing numbers of kind of neo-greens, I guess they call them, who say because nature is more resilient, think, don't worry so much.
Yeah,
And
I hate them.
that's a real slippery slope, because that starts to select for only those that are tough and adaptable, and we've already done too much of that. But indeed, one still is impressed by how fast things can come back. The striped bass, we really did not expect that stunning a comeback. It was rapid and immense, to the point we're now worried they may be outstripping their food supply.
Right. So the we have just a couple minutes left, and I guess the question I would like to ask you, I guess two more questions. One of them is, so if you could have people take away one thing that they know, oh, actually, no, I've got a question instead of that. The question instead of that is, if they made you king of Chesapeake Bay, and you can't get rid of all agriculture, you can't do that for a year. So instead, what I'm asking is, what would you do within the current capitalist system, once again, we recognize the whole system needs to go, but leave that aside. Within the capitalist system, if they made you the czar of Chesapeake Bay and you could implement policies, what would you do?
I'd be mighty tempted to create a huge tree planting corps, maybe something akin to the old CCC back in the Depression, mobilizing tens, if not hundreds of thousands of young people and old people, whoever wanted to join in, to plant trees. I've never seen a stream or a river with heavily forested that didn't have good water quality, or almost never. So I think I would plant trees, and of course we're doing that, but not nearly enough, and we'd have to stop cutting them. But I think that might be my first act as a czar, is to create a massive tree planting corps, and do that everywhere we could, and especially next to the water and from the water back. And yeah, that might take up a little bit of farmland, but we wouldn't take up too much of it. I think that would that within within the limits of being realistic, I think that's what I would do.
Okay.
I like trees. Trees are good. Even if they didn't clean the water up, I'd plant trees, you know?
Which could help with water temperature too, at least.
Well, it does. It provides structure, root structure for stream banks and habitat. The woody debris falls in the water and promotes denitrification, which is taking some of the fertilizer out and putting it back in the atmosphere. There's, some people have said, we can never do just one thing. Well, when you do something good for the environment, this is fortunate and hopeful. You almost never do just one thing. You plant a tree to clean up the water, and you clean up the air, you provide habitat, you denitrify pollution, and you make me happy because trees are pretty, and maybe promote tourism for fall color. So you can do that. We never do just one thing in a positive way as well as a negative way.
So the last question is, if somebody's listening to this interview and they live in the Chesapeake Bay region, semicolon, or if they live out of the Chesapeake Bay region, those two different questions really, what would you like for them to do? How can they help?
Well, probably the simplest one is vote. We just had a governor elected in Maryland on very low turnout, who probably isn't going to be as kind to the environment as his opponent. And a bigger voter turnout might well have changed the face of that election, as well as a lot of similar outcomes in smaller races in governor. Not enough of us vote what we say. We want candidates to be green, but I see so many politicians who aren't green, and they aren't really penalized for it. So why should they change their behavior? So I think getting the vote out for politicians that will care about the environment might be one of the most basic things we can do, and it surely needs doing. We're not doing that very well. I would support environmental groups. We've got a lot of good ones working on a lot of good things. I would also push those environmental groups to start talking and thinking about things like population and alternatives to the grow or die economy, because they are, in my opinion, almost without exception, nationally and regionally, the environmental groups not willing to get into that big piece of the puzzle, and I think they should. But still, the things they are doing are worth supporting. So, I don't have any novel or magic solutions. I don't think there are any. A lot of smart people have been thinking for a long time. You've just got to do all the things we've spent the last 30 or 40 minutes talking about, and I don't know of anything else that works.
Well, thank you so much for A, your work, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Tom Horton. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.